Hello, welcome back, everybody, to another year of the Sunday Podcast.
I'm Ollie Lum.
And I'm Matt Seddon.
Back in 2025 for our fifth season. You can expect more of this.
He's claiming that he was ill before the semifinal, whatever. But, you know, I just feel like at that point he was just looking for attention.
And some of this.
And you normally say no human is limited. So I can't limit myself, or I can't just say I can do.
As well as event coverage around all the major races on the UK circuit.
And if you're a fan of the pod, please give us a rating and review on your preferred podcast streaming service.
And if you want to stay up to date with all the latest news, give us a follow on Instagram at Sunday Podcast.
As always, thanks for listening. See you next time. And we hope you enjoyed the episode.
Hello, guys, and a very warm welcome back to another episode of the Sunday Podcast, brought to you by sportshoes.com. As always, Mr. Carl Merber on the podcast today. And whilst Carl had an impressive career as a US international himself, today was all about Grand Slam track, where he's the race director. Grand Slam kicks off next weekend in Kingston, Jamaica. And Matt and I can't wait. We're really looking forward to seeing how the new format unfolds. And today's episode for you guys is really to hear from Kyle all about Grand Slam, the kind of start of it, him obviously working with Michael Johnson, who heads it up, and how they've put together some of the race fields for next weekend. Chris obviously going in there, Josh Kerr will be going, Neil Gawley will be going over in that kind of 800, 1500 meter double, and obviously loads more international athletes as well. So loads to look forward to. Enjoy this episode with Kyle. He obviously says it a lot better than we do. You get all the scoop on what it's like for the athletes, what it's going to be like for the crowd, what we can expect. And so enjoy this episode with Kyle. Look forward to the event itself, and we'll catch you guys very, very soon. Okay, Kyle, first off, great to have you on a podcast. Welcome. You're in New York right now, is that right?
Yeah, I'm in Westchester, which is, you know, the suburbs of New York City. It's a short train ride into Manhattan.
Okay, New York for us then, but maybe not for the true New Yorkers.
No big buildings around me, but I can get there very quickly if I need to.
Is that Grand Slam headquarters? Why New York?
No, I'm from New York originally, and the majority of the team is out in LA. And it's funny, when MJ first approached me about joining the team, they did a soft ask of like, would you consider moving to LA? And I was like, listen, guys, love what you're doing. Going to be rooting for you all the way from New York. As in, I'm not leaving in my own HQ. Unfortunately, my job allows me that, you know, I'm traveling a lot constantly. And I just talk to agents all day, so I can do that from anywhere.
Good stuff, mate. And you obviously mentioned Grand Slam, and we'll get into that in a bit, but we wanted to chat to you about, I guess, what happened post retirement for you from running. So obviously a 352 miler yourself, and retire what, 4 years ago now, is that right? Something like that.
You know, I like to say I retired just before Super Shoes came in. You know, I deserve the asterisk if that ever happened in the record book, but yeah, I'd say the pandemic kicked me out.
Mm-hmm. Okay, was that the main reason? Was that kind of just disruptions there, or was it last time anyway?
It was a blessing. It was time. I'd been dealing with injuries the last 2-3 years of my career, and it gave me an excuse to hang it up without having to do one more Olympic trials. So, it's a tough decision for everyone to make, but when, you know, the entire world shuts down and there's no good races for a while, it makes it a little bit easier.
I think we just want a storyboard from where you are now, which is working with Grand Slam in one of the probably most innovative events athletics has seen in a decade or more. You know, from when you retired, what did that look like? Like, how have you got to where you are now?
Yeah, good question. I do want to say innovative. You know, what's number two then? The mixed 4x4? I did a mixed 4x1K in Edinburgh once. That would be pretty innovative and fun.
It's true. That's my big three.
I guess, you know, my own story. So as I just mentioned, after my career, hung it up and then was sitting around during the pandemic trying to figure out what in the world I wanted to do next. You know, explored the idea of staying in the sport immediately, whether it's like working in a shoe company or one of the various, you know, jobs that exist in the industry. And, you know, ultimately got turned down by a few, which, you know, is a nice blessing because my resume ultimately was just my mile time. And decided to just get a plain old desk job. You know, I worked in marketing at American Express, and I think that was like a good foundational first step. The first time you know, having a big boy job is a good learning experience and totally different from being on the track. But, you know, I started that and immediately, it's not like I stopped being a track fan. And I think for me, throughout my entire career, I was, while myself a professional for 7 years, I was a fan first. Like I was from a very young age, very into the sport. As you know, my goal was to one day be a professional runner. It's not like I happened chance into it. Like that was the plan from a young age. And so I had like the itch to scratch to keep talking about it. And I started a newsletter called The Lap Count. And I wrote that, and basically it was just, you know, an outlet to keep talking about track and giving my thoughts. And, you know, especially in the beginning, I think was able to provide a little bit of behind the scenes insight from a former professional athlete, someone who had a lot of very personal relationships with the athletes that we were watching, and did that while simultaneously working at a desk. And then eventually, you know, my friendship with Chris Chavez, you know, he was working on Sidious Mag. And at the time, you know, it was somewhere in between a blog and, you know, a business. And, you know, we eventually came together and turned it to actually be a proper business and take things up a level. And so for a while I was doing both the desk job and talking about running all the time. That was my few year immediately post professional career. And then eventually MJ came knocking.
Yeah. You mentioned obviously leveling up Sidious Mag a bit. And I think that's definitely fair to say, because Sidious Mag has been around for a while, but it seemed to be kind of a year or two after you joined that it did really start leveling up. And it must've been a hard decision, even though you've got Michael Johnson, obviously on the phone, it must have been a hard decision to leave that when it had been growing so much over a short space of time, really.
Yeah. And, you know, I think particularly in the beginning there, it's how do you turn something that was a passion project, you know, for myself, but especially Chris, something that he had been doing for a really long time. And how do you transition that into something that actually generates revenue, which, you know, it's a challenge and it's difficult, and we were able to do it and had a lot of fun in the process. But I think for me, I never really wanted to be a commentator or a media guy or content creator or anything of that. I just happened to like talking about track. And so it was an easy place to do it and allowed me to do other things and still show up at track meets and like enjoy watching track meets. And, but then when Grand Slam and, you know, that possibility came about, it just more aligned with the things that I probably wanted to do immediately post that weren't available at the time, but had, you know, timed things properly that a few years later, the opportunity was real.
Mm. When do you get wind about Grand Slam? And I wanted to ask you, though, what was your relationship like with Michael Johnson prior to Grand Slam? How many times had you even met?
Yeah, so we'd only met a few times. There's a really good interview that we did, and the first time I met him properly was in Eugene for the World Champs, and I'd encourage you to go back and like watch this video that we did in the backyard of our Airbnb between sessions. And it was, you know, we're sitting down in the backyard, and we basically just talked shop about, you know, if you had the opportunity to improve the sport, or like, what are the issues that you see? What do you want to do about it? And MJ just like lines out more or less his vision for Grand Slam track right then and there. And this is 2022. But we just had a really good hour plus long conversation and a lot of alignment. And from there, stayed in touch. And, you know, I think the thing that MJ and I always really saw eye to eye on is the fact that track is a professional sport, and there are things that we're doing and the way that it currently operates that doesn't necessarily treat it always as a professional sport. But, you know, the vision was, how do you get it to continue to improve that aspect and, you know, operate more like a business, and the athletes being treated as professionals in everything that they do. And so we had many good conversations. He, you know, became a regular reader of The Lap Count and podcast listener. But the first time that I actually heard about it was the same as everyone else, when I heard that he raised a bunch of money. And I wrote about it just basically saying, this is awesome, like really excited. These are the reasons why it's good. And then at the end, I think I threw in like a toss away line that was, you know, and MJ, when you need me, you know where to find me. Like, I'm here for you. And the next day he reached out and we had a conversation, and he was like, So I'm here. What's up? Like you said, to reach out, and from there things blossomed.
Wow. What a great way to do it. Because we were going to ask, like, if you kind of pitch the idea, or not pitch the idea, sorry, but pitch yourself to him. But I guess you've been doing that organically through these conversations and that original interview.
Yeah, that's probably a good way to put it. Like, I was probably having a job interview, you know, 2 years prior without even realizing it. But I mean, my role is really unique. So, you know, officially, I'm the senior director of racing. And what that means is I go out and I get the athletes. So, you know, trying to put together, ultimately, the product is the athletes and the races, right? And so my job is to put together the best product of, you know, of all the athletes that you hope to watch race each other, and trying to make that happen. And, you know, I think I was well positioned to do that because I'm definitely a fan of the sport first, as I said, and, you know, from 100 all the way up, really, really, I guess 62 I'm throwing there. Really love the sport, follow it closely. And I think, you know, it's a dream job. It's really fun. Like, you know, it's like I'm playing fantasy track. And I think the final result of what we're going to see starting in Kingston in a few weeks is going to be a dream matchup after dream matchup, and something that you never get, especially this early in the season. It's Olympic final caliber fields for many athletes' first meet of the year.
I was going to ask you, what was your initial reaction when you kind of heard about Grand Slam, but you clearly believed in it from the offset, and hence, you know, those early discussions with Michael Johnson. But then were you apprehensive how it was kind of going to go down, and how you were actually going to implement it? You know, once the idea was there, you know, we just spoke about running just has not changed in 100 years plus.
Yeah. And, you know, like, I think I had the same initial questions that anyone else would have had. And, you know, it's like, well, how's this going to work? And what happens in this situation? How do you convince people to do X, Y, Z? And like, is this format, like, what are the benefits? And I think the thing that that made me realize is like how much thought was put into it, how much market research was done, how many different models and everything was basically created in order to ultimately not only put together the best package for fans, but also a package for growth and business and supporting itself. You know, there's a lot of really fun things that come out of this format that I think people are starting to catch on to, like, especially now that the fields are out, it's starting to get a little bit real. Like, I know that you guys have spent time, you know, debating about who's going to win that 800, 1500 group, right? That's by design. That's not like an accident where you're really intrigued to see how Mark Ray Rope and Emmanuel Wignoni doing a 1500. And if Cole Hocker and Josh Kerr can hang in an eight, like, that's fun. It's fun to think about if Masai Russell or Kieran Nugent are going to have a faster flat 100, like, it's something you have no idea about. That's what sports is, right? Like, it's not just about watching. It's about the debates and everything that happen outside of it. It's why people listen to your podcast. It's why you go on a run for 2 hours on a Sunday morning and all you do is talk about running. So that's a fun part of the sport. And the line I always use is that right now, in many ways, the sport is enjoyed in retrospect. Like, you talk about, you find the result in a Sidious Mag graphic, and then you go back and you watch the race. And it's like, well, you just took out all the element of fun, which is not only watching the event live, but the whole hype and the buildup to that very moment. And yesterday when we announced the fields 22 days before the first event, something that does not happen. No track meet ever has announced a lineup, a full field that long in advance. Well, now we have 3 weeks to dissect it and talk about it and dive into the stats and like predict and just think about it and build the hype. And then when it finally happens, all that lead up builds that like anxious energy that you get before any, you know, world championship or Olympic final, stuff that you've been thinking about waiting for a long time.
Yeah, absolutely. As the, I guess, the race director then, you mentioned the athletes, they're the stars. That's the real product here. How do you go about sitting down and deciding who you're going to go after first and what that, I guess, wish list looks like? And,
yeah.
then maybe how realistic it is to achieve that wish list.
Yeah. And I guess I do want to quickly touch on one thing, the idea that like the athletes are stars, right? Like 100%. But I think for a really long time, we've been so focused on one star. And it's like building entire anticipation, everything up about where one person is going to run fast. There's one person going to jump far enough or jump high enough. And it's like, no, like it's about multiple stars matching up against each other, right? Like it's the race itself. And that is an element of things that we take into account when selecting a field, right? Like who is going to create the most enticing matchups? So again, like looking at the 800, 1500, like it's obvious things like personal best and medals. Like there's no doubts about that. But it's also like, all right, well, who brings something to the race that is really interesting component to it that's going to have you speculating and wondering what's going to happen? Is this going to work out? You know, I think there's a few things like, you know, having two events, essentially, it's like, all right, well, you want a balance of athletes who are, you know, specialists in one or the other. Is this athlete really good at the 100 and maybe not so good at the 200? Well, then we'll bring in this athlete who's really good at the 200 and maybe more of an unknown in the 100. Have some athletes that are strong down the middle, create more interesting dynamics, but also, you know, momentum and the young stars and the up and comers. Like an athlete that I'm really excited for in Kingston is Alana Reed, you know, Jamaica's U20 100 meter champ, young star who so many people are excited to see how she's going to do and continue to progress as she, you know, rises up in the ranks. And Jamaica has such a great history of incredible 100 meter runners. And it's like, all right, well, like Grand Slam can be the platform by which you can continue to watch her compete against the best. So I think all those things come together to say, when you look at the lineup, you should be excited by a few different things.
Some of the big stars, like, you know, the Kerrs, the Hockers, the Sydney McLaughlins, et cetera. I mean, did you find yourself selling the event to them? Like, was there an element of you got to convince these athletes, or was it kind of as easy as calling them up on the phone and they were like, hell yeah, we want to be involved?
No, because you got to think back like to some of these early conversations. And Josh is such a good example because, you know, Josh is our first guy to sign to the league. And my first conversation with Josh, we have nothing. We have an idea. We have like a 12-page pitch deck in which I'm sitting there across from the table from him and his agent, basically being like, this is what we think is going to happen. Like, we think the meets are going to be here. We think they're going to be these dates. We think, or like, we believe, maybe a better way to say it. And more so, it was looking to see the athletes that wanted more out of the sport. And, you know, I would say the beginning conversations were a lot harder because you needed to find the athletes like Sydney and Josh who the current structure of the sport, they're not super pleased with. Like, they want to race the rivals.
You wanted to go after the big fish before you kind of signed, you know, all the others.
Well, I mean, once you see that, once you see that Sydney and Josh are signed, like, talk about legitimacy. And if you're that next athlete behind them and you're going, all right, well, I want to race Josh. And if you're telling me I can race Josh 8 times by signing, then I'm in, because, you know, that's ultimately what gets the athletes excited as much as the fans is racing meaningful races with stakes versus other people who are, you know, the very best in the world. And so in the beginning, some athletes were easy. I say that about Josh, but Josh was easy because he wants that. He's pumped. He's been an incredible ambassador, and we're not feeding him those lines. Like, that is stuff Josh truly believes and is excited about. And because of that, I think it gets other athletes excited. And then the dominoes start to fall, and all of a sudden, like, you're talking to the 40th athlete and they're like, well, look at the 39 athletes who signed before me. Like, this thing has got serious momentum. I want to be a part of it. And look, like, some athletes that we maybe had conversations with in year one, being a challenger just made more sense. Like, yeah, I'll come to one or two. And that flexibility is designed as part of the system, and it'll make it fun when they come and they race once or twice.
Yeah, obviously, one thing that came out right at the start, and I'm sure was a big incentive for the athletes, was the, I guess, the financial incentive. And I'm sure you can't go into, I guess, too much of the nitty gritty of that, but how do you go about securing that? Because this has been the problem with the sport the whole time, right? Is that everyone's like, well, there's no money, so we can't do these meets. We can't do what you guys are about to do. You're literally weeks away from doing it. But historically, the excuse has been, well, the money doesn't exist, so we can't professionalize the sport in this way, and we can't go there. So how do you go about doing that when, as you've just mentioned, it's an idea, it's still an idea, and it doesn't exist, and you've got to get the money to then bring the athletes in, and vice versa. So
yeah, I mean, I think ultimately, I mean, I didn't personally raise the money. But this is not like a product that we don't know if people are going to like or not. Like, we know people like running. We know people like track. You see them tune in to the Olympics every 4 years, and it's the most popular sport in the world. You see the opportunity. I think the number is like 2.5 billion people have registered some interest in running or track, or, you know, it's already a popular sport. Just the infrastructure isn't necessarily there to support that interest. And so people, you know, they want to like it. It's not like, you know, it's not like some brand new sport that you have to go out and be like, convince people of the value in it and the rules. It's like, no, people see it. Like, go to any park run, or, you know, just look out your window on any given morning. It's like, people run, like, people like it. And during the Olympics and during the World Championships, they tune in. So I guess all that to say is, you know, it's not even so much the money for a lot of the athletes, though. And I think that's a little bit of like a misunderstanding. I think for a lot of, like, of course the money's good. Like, you know, winning $100,000 is great. And, but even more so is, I think, just the other stuff is they want to race each other. Like, they want people to watch them. That's like one of the biggest selling points in the world. And I think when you consider a meet like we're heading towards, right? Like the first slam in Kingston, talk about an event that's going to have so many eyes on you. That is going to be watched, and that's your job. Like, that's why you work so hard every single day, is because you want people to watch you perform and, you know, demonstrate your ability. And I think athletes were just looking for that platform. You know, that's the goal. And I think the structure will make it easier for fans to be fans rather than having to jump through hoops to find out who is racing when. You watch the Olympics, you have, you know, maybe you really, really connected and you know, you learned the story behind Matthew Hudson Smith and you're rooting for him. And then you go, all right, well, when can I like get a ticket to go watch him again? Or where can I, you know, how do I follow him? And it's like, oh, well, you kind of just have to like watch everything and hope that he pops up somewhere, as opposed to saying, all right, April 4th to 6th, he's going to be in Kingston. May 2nd to 4th, he's going to be in Miami, and, you know, be able to just lay out his schedule for the season. And that's a huge unlock.
That's so true. On that, how do you future-proof who's going to be the racers, who's going to be the challengers? I'm just thinking ahead to 2026. You get this initial season done and dusted. I can imagine you're going to have just about every athlete knocking on your door like, I want to be a part of this. I think it's a no-brainer for so many athletes. Are you going to have to design a qualification system at some point? Are you going to take the top four at the end of this year and say, right, you guys are all going to be racers next year? How's it going to work?
Yeah, I mean,
or is it always going to be
that's the job.
You on the phone going, we like the look of you,
yeah,
and you come?
I mean, I hope that's the problem, right? Like, that'd be an awesome problem to have, is that, you know, every single athlete after year one is so excited about joining the league that, you know, we're fighting them off. That'd be wonderful. And I think it's already starting to happen, as we're seeing with challengers, is the athletes, you know, they want this. They want change. It's, you know, they want people to watch them, and of course they want to get paid for doing it. And so you know, the racers' contracts are arranged from 1 to 3 years. You know, there's always that opportunity to, if you run well, you know, next year there's going to be spots open. You know, the roster from 1 year to the next is probably gonna have a lot of consistencies because we have top athletes in the world, and top athletes in the world are generally good again and again. But that does not mean that there's no room for someone else to come in. But, you know, I sit down with our committee and I lay out the facts and figures of who is running well, who we're looking at. You know, there's a scouting report essentially. It's saying, you know, these are the pros and cons of each athlete and their strengths and weaknesses. It's an analysis. It's just like any, I guess, football club would be looking at their potential pipeline of athletes to sign in the same way.
You mentioned that would be a great position to be in. What would success look like? And I guess with the first meet and then with the whole season, like what would that look like for you guys?
It's a good question. I think, you know, again, like, it is a startup, and, you know, what that measure of success is for any startup is growth. If we see interest continuing to grow from both athletes and fans, then that's great. That's really, you know, if we see more people tuning in to Los Angeles at the end of the season than we saw tune in to Kingston, you know, that's growth. That's great. And so that's a huge barometer. that we'll have. And then also just, you know, like, are the athletes having a really positive experience? What is their feedback? But ultimately, I feel like we're going to know. Like, I feel like we're going to fans see the benefits of the infrastructure in place as the season continues to progress. You know, I think that is the ultimate measure. But yeah, I mean, there's revenue, or there's ticket sales, or there's viewership. I think the same way that you would measure any other professional league, which again, we are now establishing rather than just being a one-off meet.
How important was it to secure those kind of broadcast deals? You know, I know over in the States, but in the UK, you know, it's going to be on TNT, our end. Michael Johnson talks about how important it was. So I guess what impact did that have?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like it's a little overlooked almost, and it's like such a big part to make this sport accessible to the entire world, right? And by the time we're finishing announcing all of our broadcast deals, will be available in 100 plus countries. But, you know, for a first year property to be able to go and align with some of the biggest broadcasters in the world here in the US, being on Peacock and CW, TNT Sport, Eurosport, like, it just shows the appetite that exists for the sport. I think the fact that, you know, not even having had the first meet and having so much buy-in from so many stakeholders, it's representative of something that I think we all know and already agree on, is that like we are sitting on a potential rocket ship of a sport here that has so much potential and should be so much bigger than it is outside of just the Olympics.
And on that coverage, what can we expect from it? Like, how is it going to be different to, I guess, your normal, your Diamond Leagues? Or fortunately, yeah, I'm sure you don't have to sit through the UK coverage, but it is dire. So what can we expect?
Yeah, I can't say too much, but I will say that like no expense has been spared on creating an unbelievable broadcast product. Something that's been really cool is our team is really diverse. And so we bring people from all over and other sports and other background, and you know, the having those other opinions and the other learning about other ways of doing things, it's really valuable to have in terms of feedback and conversation. In terms of like specifics of the broadcast, you know, again, some of the things that are advantages for the fans, which is knowing exactly who the fields are, you know, more than 3 weeks ahead of time, that's a huge advantage for broadcast too. Like you can build out a lot more within our contracts, our content days. So from a production side of things, well, now there's more storytelling to be told. That means between races, you're going to be able, rather than just sitting and looking at the track and pretty pictures zooming out the entire time, waiting for the next one to start, you know, you get some background. You know, we have production crews visiting the racers all over, having them sit down and tell their stories and footage of them in practice and these, you know, to basically create narratives and create investment with fans in order to connect with them. You know, I think it's just gonna, it's gonna look very pretty. It's very much like an entertainment product is more of the approach of, you know, the TV coverage rather than just here's someone holding a camera, watching run around the track. It's should be a very good 2 to 3 hour show depending on where you're.
That's the TV. What about in person? Will the fan experience kind of be any different in person in the stadium? And Kingston is around the corner. How are ticket sales going for Kingston? Are we expecting to see a full house?
Did you see by chance the Messi match last night? Did you see the stadium was rocking? The new track, man. I mean, Kingston's pumped. This is like it's a really exciting thing to have the athletes coming there to race. And of course, you know, there's a number of Jamaicans that are going to be in the fields themselves and they're going to be supporting their own. But also to have, you know, Dean Asher-Smith and Gabby Thomas and Sydney McLaughlin and Emmanuel Lignoni and Cole Hocker, like all these athletes from all over the world descending onto, you know, essentially the sprint capital of the world. You know, there's no lack of fandom in Jamaica. So they're excited. You know, I think the in-person experience, you know, the similar to what I was saying previously about like that buildup and that anticipation, you have to do that in stadium as well, right? Like build up the hype to each race, you know, really take a moment to appreciate the athletes before the race and then also celebrate the victories afterwards. And that's all part of the show. And I think from the very beginning, the idea is that this is not just a track meet, but it's like a sport sporting event. And we looked at other sporting events to see what are they doing in between the action to make things fun and to build up the to that key high stakes moment. And so we're doing lots of fun things in order to get that there. And yeah, should be fun if you have a packed stadium. It only makes things better.
Yeah, absolutely. And obviously you mentioned Kingston, but there's a whole host of venues kind of coming up. And how was it securing those? Was that something that you really looked into in detail in terms of where you want to put the meets? And you've picked some big stadiums as well. So it is a big stadium to fill. But if you've got the interest, then that's ideal, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, every stadium brings its own, and you see that across the sport always. Like, it's kind of like in baseball, every single dimension of the field is very different. I don't know if you guys are baseball fans, but like there's different lengths of what a home run is in different parts of the park and different stadiums all around. And while every track is 400 meters around, the experience in every stadium is very different. And I think we're definitely going to see that. Excited to be able to give a different flavor in each. There's definitely, you know, from our team, a big focus on leaning into the culture of each of the different venues that we're going to be a part of and cities that we're going to be visiting. But, you know, I think particularly, and I know that obviously being a UK-based podcast that, you know, you guys might have to stay up a little later to watch this first year. But, you know, you just look at the potential of the US fan base and you see what happened in Formula One, in which for years and years, this was a sport in Europe and it was not a super popular sport in the US, right? And I think that we know the sport is already really popular in Europe. Like, we see the crowds, but we also know that the US has an extremely competitive team and athletes, and that a lot of the top athletes in the world come to the US to live and train. And so it seems like a missed opportunity if we just always say the US, they're just not as big of track fans as in Europe. Like, all meets should just be in Europe because that's where the fans are. And it's like, well, why are we writing off this huge potential fan base? Like, especially when there's the athletes and the talent that would be easy to get behind and generate, and the money that could come from it. And so again, the way that Formula One came over to the US, to Miami and Austin and Las Vegas, and every time it's expanded into the US, there's a little bit of like, really? Like, why are you in the US? And then you see what's happened, and all of a sudden everyone in the US likes Formula One. And so I think that for us, especially in year one, having that North America focus, it's like, I hope to start waking a sleeping giant of a fan base that will have ripple effects across the world.
And is there scope to, you know, you talk about going across the world and make it truly global in that sense. Is there scope to have more meetings, or do you see four a year as the kind of limit? You know, that's eight races for a lot of these athletes already. Is that the kind of...
Yeah. I mean, I would say for year one, it's head down, let's put on four great track meets. That doesn't necessarily mean that at some point in the future, there won't be more. Never say never. Right now, it's, I mean, again, like, we just announced this Kingston field yesterday. And it's like, oh my God, I have to fill the Miami field now. And yeah, like, I can't even think about the possibility of, you know, years beyond at the moment. And I'm sure the rest of our team feels very similarly. But that is all to say, like, it's not, yeah, it's going to be four forever. And I don't want to say that on a podcast. And then when we announce a fifth one day, however many in that, it's like, well, they promised us it would only ever be four. So, you know, that's the commissioner's job. Figure that out. I'll just fill the fields.
Absolutely. And look, there is another, I guess, league format of athletics in the world, in the Diamond League. And how are those tensions kind of being a Grand Slam track? Because we obviously see it from the outside. And Are you kind of aware that they're kind of looking on and waiting really to see what you do? And it seems like they've tried to respond a bit. I guess Matt and I have spoken about it on the podcast before. We don't think it's probably enough. But is that something that you guys are kind of consciously aware of? Because there are, like you say, a lot of meets across Europe that are technically a league format, but it's not quite the same as what you guys are planning to do.
Yeah, I mean, it's not like I'm regularly having conversations with anyone in other meets. I think we're just, again, focused on what we're doing. I think if we succeed in what we're hoping to achieve, that ultimately just lifts up all the sport. you know, if we can bring in new fans, that helps everyone. And so, you know, that is our goal, just do a great job with what we're trying to do. You know, we have a great relationship with World Athletics, and, you know, creating opportunities for fans to watch and for athletes to get paid a lot, like, ultimately, you know, that seems like a good thing for everyone.
Just, I want to iron out a format before we finish, but just before that, what happens? I mean, is it Grijalva? I think Grijalva's down injured, right? So he's not going to be a racer for this first meet, at least. How does that impact him as an ad, like his contract and the rest of the season? You might not be able to go too much into that. Obviously, you've kind of filled his spot with a challenger.
Yeah. So if an athlete gets injured or if a racer gets injured, you know, we fill it with an additional challenger. And unfortunately, that's just part of the sport, right? So, you know, hope that he's back healthy and ready to go in Miami. So on that front, you know, no big deal. And again, like, we do what we can and we offer our medical team in order to be able to support and, you know, whatever we can do to help. And that's one of the benefits of being a racer, is that guaranteed lane in all four slams. So, you know, for so many athletes, you have one early season injury, all of a sudden, you know, you come out and you maybe don't have a time to show for the season, or you don't have a fast time to show that first one out, and all of a sudden you can't get a lane anywhere. And one of the benefits of being a racer is, well, hey, you're a little hurt, it's fine, missed first one, come on back. So it's that's one of the many benefits of being a racer, is that opportunity to keep coming back.
Awesome. And I think it would just be cool for you to just give a brief summary of how it's all going to work. I mean, we know ourselves, but I think, you know, still a few people might be confused, or they know there's going to be sprints, they know there's going to be distance. But yeah, what are the categories and how's the overall win decided?
Yeah, so there is 6 event groups on both the men's and the women's side. And so it's short sprints, long sprints, short hurdles, long hurdles, short distance, long distance. So I know, as a former 8:15 guy, calling it short distance rather than middle distance, you know, took a little getting used to, but the short long makes it easy. And so athletes compete twice over both distances. You get a point total based off of your place of finish, and then the highest combined score receives the $100,000 and trickles down. So 8th place gets $10,000, still in the middle, but you have to compete well in both events. I think one of the big advantages of that is consistency. You know, it values consistency. It, of course, values winning because you have the most points, but then also it values having a range of strengths. So to be good in the 800 and the 1500, to be good at, you know, the hurdles and a flat race. And the thing that we've actually seen is the athletes are probably more excited to run their off event, quote unquote, than they are their main event, especially the hurdlers. They all think they're going to win the flat. Like, across the board, they're so confident. So, yeah, you know, I mean, it's, I don't know if you need me to run through the specific events that are in each, but the short sprints is the 100 and the 200. The long sprints is the 200 and the 400. But it's different overlap in the 200. So the 8 athletes in the short sprints race each other in the 100 and the 200. And then a separate 8 athletes race each other in the 400 and the 200. Then in the hurdles, it's the 110 or the 100 hurdles and a flat 100, and then a 400 hurdles and a 400 is the long hurdles. Then short distance is an 800 and a 1500, and then the long distance is the 5K and the 3K. And of note is that there's no pacers or rabbits in any of the distance events. It's championship racing, which we love.
A cool rule that I saw, if it's a tie on points, you'll go down to a cumulative time. Will be, yeah, know, that person will finish by the other. And, you know, that's probably going to mean that distance races might have to roll along at a pretty good speed in some scenario.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. Like, I mean, if you look at, I mean, either of the fields in Jamaica for the men's or women's long distance, like, there's a few athletes in there who, you know, are not going to let it jog. And we see it all the time at the championships, you know, like, you see it at European indoors and you saw it at the Olympics, like, things still move. Like, they're not crawling for it's someone's benefit at some point to make the race honest, but there, it's just so much more unpredictable. I remember watching the women's 1500 prelims at Europeans, and like, I've never seen more lead changes in a race, or at least like, it doesn't feel like you see that sort of thing anymore, because if there is a rabbit, then you just get in line. And is predictable. And then what you're really getting is a 400 meter race rather than a 1500 meter race. And so I'm a big proponent of no rabbits and making championship style racing, gets the heart. And it's just not about like every race having to be about how fast you run. It just it takes away from the spirit of the sport. And, you know, I was listening to Coffee Club podcast today, and those guys were talking about the fact that it's like, yeah, you just want to go out and like race. Like, don't worry about chasing standards, chasing personal best, like just beat people. And I think from a fan's perspective, there's more, you know, just what's going to happen. No idea.
Would you say athletes have been a lot more excited about that as well? You know, the prospect of going into a race knowing, oh, thank God, there's not going to be wave lights. It's not going to be going out in 55 for the first laps. Like that unpredictability, yeah, I mean, probably gets them a little bit more excited.
It gets a little stale when you always know that a race is just going to be, you know, this is exactly the time that we're going to try to hit every step of the way. And then it's just like, I hope I have enough. And it's like, I saw someone talking about, like, you know, why don't they have rabbits or why don't they have pacers? I want to see the athletes go all out. And I was like, they're still going to go all out. Just the distribution is going to be a little bit differently. But trust me, at the end of a 5K, whether there's a rabbit or not, like, you're going to be laying out on the track. And so I think it's more fun. And rather than it just 100% being a test of fitness, which I think when you have a rabbit and pacing lights, that's what it is it's not a race. It's just a test of fitness. When you take that out and you bring in strategy and tactics and elbows, all of a sudden that's a race.
Absolutely. And I guess a couple questions in here, but as race director, are you kind of privy to people's shape and how they're getting on behind the scenes? And with that, who are you most looking forward to seeing?
Yeah. I'm definitely like relatively aware of things. I think for me, the thing I'm most excited about is those unpredictable, like, ones that, like, what is Emmanuel Lignone going to run in a 1500? And, like, what is Mark Bayrup going to run? Like, that's so exciting to me. What is Mary Mora? Mary Mora has no 1500 time to her name. Like, what is she going to do? And, like, that's fun to me. I don't know. Like, that gets me more excited than anything. So, yeah, I mean, who am I really excited about? I think I'm just excited about seeing those athletes that never would have otherwise raced each other. And similar to the hurdlers who are excited about the flat races, like, I know that they're going to go out and they're going to run 12 low, right? Like, they're going to run fast in 100 hurdles. Who's the fastest? Like, straight up, take the hurdles out and you see how fast Akira Nugent has run. I don't know if you guys have seen, like, Jasmine Camacho Quinn run a 200. Like, she's just legitimately an elite 200 meter runner. Like, I don't know. That's really fun. I think that's fantasy.
It's a good way of putting it.
Yeah. What are you guys most excited about?
We're distance biased. We are distance biased. So, you mentioned on those matchups in definitely that short distance event. I think the 8 and 15, we have lost quite a few 8 and 15 runners. Like, kind of, you've got Hobbs Kessler, but, you know, beyond that, not many of them exist. So actually, you know, encouraging that again, I think it's going to be very interesting. But also, I think because there's four slams, how things go in that first one, it could look so different in the fourth slam. You're going to have guys, especially like you think about the 3 and the 5, you're going to have guys who have done, they're on their 8th race, you know, that last 5K or that last 3K. You've got some fresh, hungry racers who are coming in, or challengers, yeah, sorry, who are coming in to sort of dethrone these races. And I just think that, like you said, there's just going to be so much hype, so much talking points around it, because there's a lot more scenarios. I think we've got a bit bored of the sport because everyone's always on their A game. It feels like that anyway. And it's cool to see people race when you're like, actually, I'm not sure if they're going to be at their best today, and they might be vulnerable.
I think, and that's a great point, is there's this idea that you can only ever race when you're at your absolute best. Like, when, what races do you see the most upsets and the most, like, absolute, like, unbelievable, shocking things happen is at, like, World Championships and Olympics, because there's no option to withdraw, right? Like, it's like, no, can we do this another day? Like, I didn't have a great week of training, or I had a bad night of sleep. Like, no, you're there. Like, this is the time to do it. And I think that a lot of appreciation to all of the athletes who signed as racers to say months in advance. I mean, Josh came on at this point, it will be, you know, what, like 10 months prior to the first race. He said, yeah, I'll be ready to go on this day. Then, you know, like, what a cool thing to call your shot and say, if you want to race me, come race me. Like, this is exactly where I'm going to be. And I'll be there whether I'm in tip-top shape or not. And look, if someone goes out in that first one and a racer gets beat because they're not on their A game, and then they turn around and they have an opportunity to beat them, those same guys, in the next one, like, what a cool storyline. That's how rivalries start. And I understand the desire to just always be chasing times. But again, like, at the core of this sport is beating people. And if everyone is there, that's like, the time doesn't matter. If you beat all of the best guys who are also on the line, now you're the fastest, regardless of what the clock says.
Yeah, I feel like the competition is going to be fierce because of that. I mean, one thing, I guess this is a little bit of a negative. What happens if, obviously, Grand Slam is early season? What happens if all those races kind of flop at Worlds in September? And does that justify, you know, those people like the Jakobs and the Keeley who are like, we're not going to commit to being a racer just yet? Does that kind of justify their decision?
I mean, if you look at like the roster of athletes, to say that like this roster is, you would need, there would be a significant number of upsets in order for this roster to not show up and earn some medals come Tokyo. But I feel like that is the current narrative, that you can only peak once and be good once throughout the year, right? But it's like, I don't know, like Jakob ran 3:45 in February. Like, are you worried about him being in tip-top shape come September? Like, no, of course not. Like, he'll be great. And so, yeah, I don't know. I just don't really like accept the premise. Like, people run fast all the time. I think especially like, look back at a generation or two, and those, they were racing constantly. Like, we race so selectively. And part of that is, you know, the reason an athlete would only race a few times a year is because at this point, the money doesn't come from racing anymore, right? Like, the money. So why race constantly? Like, you're not running for anything of significant stake. You know, I think that we've seen throughout history that athletes are capable of racing much, much more. And we've seen plenty of athletes run very fast indoors and continue the season well into, you know, the depths of the season. So, yeah,
it's a very, I agree with that.
So I don't accept the premise. I push back.
There you go. Great response. And I think great place to end as well, because we're looking forward to it. We can tell you're looking forward to it, and I'm sure everyone listening is as well. So Carl, thanks so much for chatting to us about Grand Slam, and thanks for coming on the podcast.
Yeah, thanks for having me, guys.